Off the Ball Breakfast.
The thing Hamer always said, when I took on this Ireland gig, the one thing I could be sure about was there's going to be a bit of dog in them. Then I realised there was no dog in them.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
The News Round on Off the Ball.
With UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
This is News Talk.
Welcome along to Monday night's Off the Ball. It's only with you till 10 o'clock this evening, and it is a busy 3 hours coming your way between now and then. So we're going to kick things off around 7:30 with Luke Jensen, who is going to try his best to make sense of what happened at Roland Garros over the course of the weekend. The women's final would have stood on its own as one of the greatest finals we've seen in recent times. And then Sinner and Alcaraz went out yesterday and said, hold my beer, and produced one of the greatest finals that we've seen in sport in quite some time. From 8 o'clock then, it's going to be hurling. The Munster final on Saturday night at the Gaelic Grounds is going to be front and centre there. And Anthony Nash is going to chat us through that one. And then Fiona Hayes and Mike Sherry will join us on Monday Night Rugby from 9. And before we wrap up, Miguel Delaney is going to take a call to talk to us about Thomas Frank's impending move to Tottenham. And we'll do a little bit of Andorra 0, England 1. Andorra has often been a canary in the coal mine for previous England managers, and not been a good weekend for Thomas Tuchel, still very early in his reign as England boss. Our number is 0879 180 180 if you want to get in touch with us on WhatsApp. Stephen Doyle will be delivering the news round. Steve-O, how are you doing?
I'm all good, thank you. Good evening, all.
And Mick McCarthy is here as well. How are you, Mick?
Great, on.
I think there's something that supersedes all of the above that we should kick things off with tonight. And I know that this is a personal cause of yours, and I know it's going to touch at the heartstrings of a lot of listeners
out there. It's what sport's all about.
It's what sport's all about. Your sporting weekend was hampered by the shithousery of a certain species.
Yeah, you've left me speechless there, Owen. But of course, Friday night, let's face it, I mean, Ireland's wonderful performance at home to Senegal, our traditional one-all draw, was completely and utterly ruined by the obnoxious presence of flying rats at the Aviva Stadium, taking over not just their presence in the stadium, but even affecting the vision and stopping us seeing probably the greatest Irish save of all time by Caoimhín Kelleher. And you're thinking to yourself, this is ridiculous. It's just over the top now. Something needs to be done. And then you're watching in another stadium in Dublin, in Croke Park yesterday, where you're watching the Leinster final. And again, those of us in Croke Park, well used to seagulls arriving at the end of games, you know, as the place clears out. But now they're not even waiting for the games to be over. So right in the middle of Galway and Kilkenny, seagulls everywhere again. It's like they're showing no respect. They don't even wait for their human betters to depart the situation before they come and scavenge. It's absolutely outrageous.
Is that a Happy Mondays reference? Is it the flying rats?
And I'd say it's a well-used reference for seagulls. Yeah. But
I know Sean Ryder had this thing about winged. He called them the winged rats, but it was actually pigeons he was talking about. It wasn't seagulls. So it was just
I saw someone saying on social media on Friday, or questioning why are the Brighton scouts there to see Caoimhín Kelleher. He's already got a club, which I thought, you know, was quite good. The seagulls have taken over, Mick. Basically, this is an absolutely outrageous ramping up of their assault on Irish sporting life, is what you're saying.
I'd consider it a escalation in their presence in a kind of a way that I would say is confronting us, basically, and urging us to do something about it. And will we just sit back and, you know, let humankind be overrun, or will we stand up for ourselves? I'm not so sure. I don't think I have the answer to that question.
The thing is, this has been something that's been a massive part of Irish discourse in the not-too-distant past as well. You know, the non-sports folk of the country have been dealing with this.
Yeah. Even 11 years ago, I think, was the most infamous moment. And there was a visionary senator from Kerry, actually, mm-hmm. Like your good self, called Senator Ned O'Sullivan, who spoke out about this in Shannadaran 11 years ago. Let's have a listen to what he said.
I think something needs to be done to address the seagull problem here in this city. It seems the seagulls have lost the run of themselves completely. I know they're getting so cheeky now that they attack young children and dispossess them of their lollipops and stuff like that. They're not seagulls. They really are vermin. They're scavenger gulls, dump gulls. They don't look for fish anymore. They want to eat the waste of human waste.
The waste of human waste. I'm surprised they didn't call them Dublin gulls.
Well, this man was ridiculed all over the internet, everywhere, from all the other countries. The BBC wrote an article ridiculing this man this great Irish visionary,
yeah.
this man who knew the threat long before the threat was real. And look at it now. Is anybody laughing at Senator Ned O'Sullivan today?
No, the neck on
probably
these
the seagulls.
To be fair, yeah, it's true. Like their protest and their imprint on Irish society went to a whole new level during the All-Ireland final last year when you had an unnamed seagull launch a 25-minute sit-down protest on the pitch. And when it was taken to Kildare Wildlife Rescue Centre, it came out that he didn't even have a broken wing. He fell from the sky for sure, but there was no broken wing. Barely a scratch on him. Was just looking for attention, it turned out. I actually don't know where that seagull is now, but Kildare Wildlife Rescue might be able to update.
Infiltrating all Ireland finals, yeah. And
well, this wait till you know we get a
looking for sympathy for it.
Mayo throwing the Oh my god, the fucking thing they put in the back of the jersey now.
GPS.
The GPS tracker. Wait till the seagull gets involved in one of those situations, the dying embers of an all Ireland final. Somebody waiting to take a.
Well, if it can take lollipops off children, Steve, they can take GPSs off. Full forward.
But it's no wonder that they're coming so far inland now. It's like we're absolutely decimating our sea life at the moment. Like the whole under the water is just. I was listening to a piece last week about the death of these fish that all the whales eat on, and they come up to the Irish coast to eat these particular whatever it is they're called, kippers or something. But they eat these and they can't find any more off the Irish coast anymore because. They're being overfished by the French and Italian trawlers. And look, maybe it's time we started to, send their own trawlers out there and start fighting them off.
There is something so deeply insulting about the seagulls coming down before an hour after the game is finished in Croke Park. It is like, you have not packed out this stadium. We are circling in front of your cameras to tell you that this is not a sellout whatsoever. And I think the same goes for the Aviva on Friday night as well. There's something about... end of days about
the that's seagulls ultimately circling. The issue is that we can't fill the seats anymore, so there's nothing to scare them off. Yeah,
exactly.
Or seagulls, we've given them an awful time here. I feel
it's the noise they make as well. Like they don't have any kind of sweet bird song, like a blackbird or a the like. It's these. It's kind of a horror film esque kind of scream, isn't it, from the seagulls?
They're huge though. Like they're up on the roof here. If you go up to the fifth floor here and you go out into the onto the balcony, they'd be on a little platform. They'd be looking you dead in the eye, the size of you.
And your lunch,
you know.
But
scary things.
Absolutely, and we saw all that when we couldn't see Caoimhín Kelleher save on Friday night as well. Just huge obstructions. I think it's fair to say. Were we watching the tennis yesterday?
I was surprised myself by watching both finals on Saturday and Sunday. I wonder has the move from free to air Eurosport to pay TV TNT actually weirdly helped because it's just. A lot more visible for the few, the minority of people who do have the sports channels. It becomes a lot more visible. You're like, oh, the tennis, whereas when it's lost on Eurosport, nobody ever checked it, you know? But anyway, I just, like, it was absolutely incredible drama. I thought the women's final was amazing. And then when you have Sinner Alcaraz in their first Grand Slam final against each other to live up to it in the way it did, you know, with Alcaraz coming from two sets down and all the drama of the fourth and fifth sets. Like, just absolutely bananas. Like, it really felt like a rebirth of tennis for me. It felt like we'd been hanging on to the old sort of Djokovic, Nadal, Federer era for so long, and it really should have moved on, and great, Alcaraz was a good new player and all, but I don't know if it captured the public interest. And then you see a final like that, and you're thinking, this is the great old days again.
So,
it was brilliant.
We can go straight in on this one now, but like, at what stage do we start to have, you know, concerns about the future of this rivalry given Jannik Sinner's not too distant history? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we'll get into it with Luke Jensen from 7:30 because he's always been quite strong at this thing, but it was a bit overbearing, like, in terms of my emotion watching this yesterday.
Hung over every shot, basically.
A little bit, and also kind of thank God he didn't win it in the end, because I think you can make a very strong case that of all the slams that Jannik Sinner is going to play, this is the one he probably shouldn't have been playing. Like, I mean, the cozy nature of his ban expiring a month before Roland Garros actually began just was always the thing that annoyed a lot of people. And like, you look through when the story was really flaring up in February, and Djokovic, when he was saying about access to top lawyers, that you can affect the outcome of your top player, an element of favouritism towards the ban for Jannik Sinner, when you had Stan Wawrinka saying, I don't believe in a clean sport anymore, Tim Henman saying that it was too convenient that he got the ban that he got, I think all of that feeds into what you're watching yesterday, and you're like, wow, this is an amazing tennis player. but there's no way he should have had a ban that went from the Australian Open right up until a month before the French Open and managed to find some sort of agreement with WADA and with the sport to allow him to have a nice, cosy ban that fit that window perfectly.
And even beyond that, Owen, I think what really struck with me when a lot of comments were being made around that ban was the lower-ranked players. There's so many lower-ranked players that came out and railed against this, and they're the kind of players that are slugging it out on the tour week in, week out, trying to make a few bob. Like, you know, these aren't wealthy, super wealthy tennis players like some of the, you know, the top ranked players. And their issue with it, like, you know, they were the ones that I was kind of looking at, well, you know, we've got to listen to these people. And it's great that, in fairness to Djokovic, he did try and give them a voice as well. But to me, yeah, the whole kind of truncated nature of that ban was very problematic.
The case resolution agreement, whenever that language started to be used around this, you were like, how powerful are Jannik Sinner's lawyers and how much does he have the anti-doping agency and the sport itself at his mercy here? Well, it was certainly something that came to my mind. And if it was any player bar maybe him or Alcaraz or maybe one or two others, it surely would have covered at least one slam.
Yeah.
One slam.
It's a ludicrous. And we've talked about it on the show.
And I think it taints what we saw yesterday. Because yesterday should go down as one of the greatest finals we have seen in the sport ever.
Should.
And I think that because it's the first one after this ban, this truncated ban, I think that it will forever be tainted as a result of that.
But I question whether, not for everybody and not even for most people, but say like tennis is coming out against Sinner in a way, and you've mentioned all the people who said it, that will dissipate over time. And he'll be forgiven and he'll be on tour and everyone will see him every week. And I think losing one of the greatest finals of all time from two sets up in a five-setter and, like, you know, in fairness, looking beaten in the fifth set and coming back into it and forcing the tiebreaker and so on, I think that people love the narrative that they see in front of them rather than the deep, let's get in and see what did he actually accuse of taking and what did he ban. And I could feel people turning over the course of the 5 hours yesterday, you know, and I don't think it will be instantaneous, but I feel like, you know, they go at it again at Wimbledon. I think people will start to love the rivalry and it will be less and less and less an issue about what happened in the last 5 months.
100%. I think it's already forgotten. Never mind, in a month's time.
It wasn't openly talked about in the coverage yesterday or anything, but I don't know if it is forgotten. I think it's still nearly the first thing we bring up here.
Like,
but
yeah, I understand why it might not be mentioned in the broadcast because it apparently takes away from the drama that we were witnessing yesterday. I don't know. I think you can make a case that it actually adds to the drama. You've got a whole heap of his contemporaries, a couple that I mentioned there, Djokovic most notably, coming out and saying he's got preferential treatment. That adds to the soap opera nature of it all, if nothing else. And like, it is the truth. It is something that's been on the record. And I would say that if you're trying to sell a product, there's no harm having this being part of the narrative because it is based in fact.
And you weren't won over by the fact that he tried to win your favour by wearing an Ireland jersey, Ireland rugby jersey from 1996, no?
I kept thinking Alcaraz was wearing the Portugal away shirt from about 2 or 3 years ago.
Alcaraz is one. Yeah, absolutely. But I thought the stiff collar was very, very rugby. And it was very, I could see Keith Wood or Eric Elwood in that jersey yesterday. But unfortunately, like, that team didn't win much, especially not in Paris. Oh, yeah. So it wasn't a great idea.
We've got a range of comments on the Seagull conversation.
Like,
it's not even like everybody's aligned. People have taken away different parts of the conversation here. So let me just go to like three of them. Sean in Dublin says it's time to bring in a crow banger in both stadiums. John in Limerick says, lads, the Seagulls are there because the fans are busy stuffing themselves with fried food and pizza slices and chucking their leftovers in the ground or on top of overfilled bins on the way to and around the Aviva and Croke Park. And an unnamed texter has been in touch to say, krill is what the whales eat. So there you go, Seagull.
Actually, no, just he said, back in your box. It's Sprat. I just remembered, Sprat is the one. Right. They eat krill
but not
elsewhere.
Kippers.
But they do come to the Irish coast for
except
their Sprat.
Except for breakfast time.
Yeah.
Right, kippers, krill, sprat. I don't know the difference between any of those things, but 087-918-180. If you've got any further insight on Seagullgate, please do get in touch. Now, the news round is with UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate, or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action. Where are you starting, Steve-O?
Yes, beginning with the Republic of Ireland squad, and there was some good news from Luxembourg today. Hamer Hallgrimsson revealed at his pre-match press conference that he'll have a full complement of 24 players to choose from. There had been doubts around Josh Honahan and Jack Taylor, but both were declared fit by the Irish boss this morning. Included in that 24 is the Stoke City midfielder, Boston Lowell, who was called up over the weekend. Assistants John O'Shea and Paddy McCarthy had been making a case for his inclusion before the call-up. Lowell signed for the Potters last summer, but his season was curtailed due to a back injury, and Harold Grimson admitted that he hasn't seen much of him in action. But while a central midfielder by trade, the head coach spoke about his ability to play across the defensive line. The Irish head coach has stated he plans to make changes while wanting to maintain a consistency in performance, but pointing to the fact that he wants to get a look at some of the new faces in the squad. Ireland's defeat to Luxembourg in that World Cup qualifier 4 years ago was raised at today's press conference. Luxembourg had a disappointing Nations League campaign, which will culminate in a League C-D relegation playoff with Malta next March. But Hall Grimson was impressed with one of their most recent performances in a friendly international.
I watched the Sweden game when they played here. They beat Sweden 1-0, could have scored more goals against Sweden. I know a little bit about them, so, and the strength of Sweden. So, no, I wouldn't look at it as a shock to the nation if we would not get good results here. It's that good team that a win here would be really good for us at this stage. So I hope nobody is taking them lightly, if that's the correct word to say.
There's some controversy surrounding Luxembourg at the moment, Steve. What's going on?
Well, basically, there was the Luxembourg Football Federation issued a statement yesterday evening after protest banners were removed at the Stade de Luxembourg at the weekend. Some supporters were expressing anger over the inclusion of 29-year-old centre-forward Gerson Rodriguez, with one of the banners reading, "Shame on you, FLF." Supporters also held up A4-sized red cards in protest over the player's participation. Rodriguez won his 70th cap in that match against Slovenia. He's one of the national team's star players, scoring 23 goals, including the winner in that qualifier against Ireland in Dublin. He was sentenced in March of last year after being found guilty of beating his then partner Emily Boland in November 2022. There were two other cases included involving assaults by the player outside a nightclub and of threatening behaviour to police officers. Rodriguez, currently contracted to Portuguese club AVS, was given an 18-month suspended sentence and several fines, and an appeal against that sentence in April was unsuccessful. In a statement, the Federation emphasised there was no instruction to remove the protesters' banners, adding that such an action never aligned with the FLS philosophy. Dialogue, listening and transparency remain fundamental values of the Federation, the statement read. The FLF apologised to all those affected by the incident and said the board would draw the necessary lessons to prevent similar incidents in the future.
Right. We also have a couple of Premier League related stories today, but there's going to be a big managerial announcement in the next day, you'd imagine.
Yeah, Tottenham have begun discussions with Brentford about making Thomas Frank their next head coach. The Dane has an €11.9 million release clause in his contract with the West London club, which Spurs have agreed to pay. The Londoners are looking for a new manager after sacking Europa League winning boss Ange Postecoglou on Friday. Manchester United have confirmed Christian Eriksen, Johnny Evans and Victor Lindelof are leaving the club when their contracts expire at the end of the month. It brings an end to Evans' second spell at Old Trafford after returning in 2023. Meanwhile, United, alongside Arsenal, are believed to be targeting Sporting Lisbon striker Victor Gyökeres. And Everton have confirmed they are offering new contracts to club captain Seamus Coleman and midfielder Idrissa Gueye. Both have deals due to expire at the end of the month.
Turning to rugby then, we've got a couple of late fitness tests for Leinster ahead of Saturday.
Yeah, well, four players remain doubtful ahead of that decider in the URC Grand Final against the Bulls. Tight head prop Tyke Furlong, centre Gary Ringrose and fullback Hugo Keenan will all be further assessed this week for calf injuries. It's the same for back row Josh van der Fleer, who has a hamstring issue. It's thought that Furlong and Keenan are the more serious concerns, but the former, along with Ringrose and van der Fleer, trained to some degree, according to coaching staff today. There has been a lot of focus on the attendances at Leinster's URC knockout matches, played in front of sparse crowds at the Aviva Stadium over the last couple of weeks. Ahead of their trip north of the River Liffey, Blues hooker Dan Sheen expressed confidence they'll get a bigger crowd with a trophy on the line.
Obviously we've had great support throughout the year, and even the last 2 weeks I thought the atmosphere was great. Obviously numbers were low, but it's obviously tricky to sell games in a week, and especially this time of the season. So, any support that we can get on Saturday would be brilliant. Hopefully they get the sort of pricing right, and it's accessible to everyone. But Yeah, we're looking forward to having to put on a good show and hopefully coming away with a trophy at the end of it. And it'd be great if we can get as many people there as possible.
Yeah, we'll have more on this with Fiona Hayes and Mike Sherry on Monday Night Rugby, which is coming your way from 9 o'clock tonight. We did have some good news from, I guess, an individual standpoint for Irish rugby today.
Yeah, Finlay Balaam has been called into the Lions squad for this summer's tour to Australia. The Connacht and Ireland prop replaces Xander Fagerson, who unfortunately for him has been ruled out due to a calf injury. A number of players were due to travel to Portugal today as Andy Farrell's squad begin their preparations for the trip down under. Now, due to Balaam's Lions call-up, it's a bit like the ad, isn't it? The rugby ad, your man's after getting dropped, so you get moved up. Anyway, fellow Connacht man Jack Ainger has been drafted into the Ireland squad for the summer tour. Ainger trained with the senior Ireland squad during the Six Nations and was part of the emerging Ireland squad last summer. Paul O'Connell's side will play Georgia and Portugal in July. Mick, get your boots.
I like that ad, but it doesn't make any sense because I don't understand why so all the provinces and all the clubs would have to replace one person. Sure, but anyway,
it's
I like
a domino
the ad.
But there's
too many dominoes. For what? For the one?
No, I see it as a piece of documentary work. Actually, I could totally buy into that.
It's a good ad.
Hollywood script.
I have to say good sentimental ad. They're very well made.
I fully believe that there in real life right now there is a man sitting in his car with his daughter and he is picking up the phone saying, "Will you come and play for the Fifths this weekend?" 100%, and it's all because Xander Fagerson got injured. Right, GA.
Yes, the GAA fixtures announced today for football and hurling. We've gone from Newbridge or nowhere to Newbridge, every code, only here all at once. The Kildare senior footballers will take on Offaly in the Tarleton Cup quarterfinals at Cedral St. Connolly's Park on Saturday at 6:30. And that will be preceded by the meeting of Lilywhite's hurlers, just crowned Joe McDonagh Cup champions, of course, against Dublin in the All-Ireland preliminary quarterfinals. That throws in at 4 o'clock. Elsewhere in the Tarleton Cup on Saturday, it's Fermanagh versus Sligo at Brewster Park, 5 o'clock. On Sunday then, Wicklow take on Westmeath at Echelon Park at 1:15. And then it's Limerick versus Wexford at the TUS Gaelic Grounds at 3:45. Now, the other hurling preliminary sees Laois hosting Tipperary on Saturday at Laois Hire O'Muir Park at 1:45. The winner, of course, faces Galway in the quarterfinal. And Galway, of course, losing that Leinster final yesterday against Kilkenny. And I suppose they did find themselves 13 points down in that final. But with a 1-6 salvo without reply, they were just 4 behind with around 68 minutes played. And of course, there was that mistake by the third choice goalkeeper, Darragh Walsh, who seemed to lose sight of that ball. And the ball came off his helmet into the path of Mossy Keogh, who duly finished and really ended Galway's faint hopes of a comeback. Speaking after that match was the Galway manager, Micheál Donoghue.
You know, in the build-up to it, you know, people saying we're back and have big opportunities. And look, we've huge belief and trust in the group. The disappointment thing is, you know, when you see what they did do for a 10-minute, 12-minute period in the game, that's the positives we're taken out of, and that's what we'll try and build on as we move forward. No, I wouldn't say a bigger job. Obviously, look, the disappointment of today, and I suppose the narrative will be that, you know, it's probably similar to previous years and previous teams. But look, we know what we have in the squad, and I said we'll try and take the positives out today as we move forward.
Yeah, disappointing enough attendance figure at Croke Park yesterday, although that only figures humans and not seagulls. And if you include the attendance yesterday, no seagulls in the Gaelic grounds on Saturday night. It feels like we've entered into like a bit of a culture war style debate about was this a good game of hurling or not, which just seems extraordinary.
Yeah, I know, and there was so much of it. Oh, it was like a good time, you know, it was intense and it was high drama, but God, the quality was awful. I was like, does it not seem weird to you that like that all of them, you know, that the quality was bad on both sides of these two great teams, just like consistently throughout the game? It's like, is there such a thing as good defending or high intensity defending? I know, maybe fouling if you want to look at it. If you want to say maybe the referee wasn't calling enough in the first couple of laps. But I just thought it was brilliant the entire way through. It was very, very low score. Both finals were actually, especially early on. I think Galway went to half an hour in actual playing time between both halves without scoring from play, which is absolutely unheard of, you know. But in terms of the Munster final, like it just never let up at all. It felt like it was going to penalties halfway through the second half, never mind before extra time. You know, you just felt like they weren't going to be able to get away from each other.
Yeah.
But I loved every minute of it. You know, it was, I don't know, what side of the culture war do you fall on?
I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And like the real debate obviously comes down to penalties. Should it or shouldn't it be a part of it? Like, I'm all for the winner on the day at this point. Like, I'd love for the intercounty season to go a little bit longer. I understand why that isn't the case. So yeah. In these current parameters, I think one of the unintended consequences which benefits the game is the winner on the day, which I just think kind of puts a bow on these massive events really neatly. And I've got nothing wrong. I've got no problem with that whatsoever. I don't want to...
Would you
all
like the All-Ireland final, the ultimate decider of the best team of the year, to be decided that way?
I wouldn't mind it.
See, I don't know. Yeah, even a World Cup final, I don't even like it, but it's the way it is, and it's the long-standing tradition of a tiebreaker in football, right? I just don't understand why that has been lifted into the GAA. And even in the football code, I don't like it, but fine, at least it makes sense. There's similarities there. But like for a completely other sport, where like how big a... Are there other, in a high scoring sport, and I've had this conversation with you before, football is a low scoring sport, so the tiebreaker has to reflect the fact that there won't be another score for a certain amount of time. In a high scoring sport, do we need the tiebreaker to be set pieces? One, right? Players pulling up a cramp and, you know, barely been able to reach the finish line the 90th minute this week might say, right, okay, maybe it does need to be some level of set piece. But I don't know. What about like, you know, a midfielder hits a ball into a forward and one defender and he can take a point or he can go for goal and they have five of them. And it's five different forwards, five different backs, and whoever ends up with the highest score. Like, it wouldn't, you know, that's not going to kill anybody, you know what I mean? And at least it would be the game. I just think you should have a shootout or, you know, whatever you want to call it, a tiebreaker, reflect the sport as much as possible. And it is possible in a game like hurling, whereas it might not be in a game like soccer.